Back today. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3632, which is precisely where we left off when we were so rudely interrupted on Tuesday. And as I recall, we want to try and set the stage just the way it was. Mike Probst, do you remember which chair you were in? Do you remember which sentence you were in the middle of when we interrupted you? Let's invite you to finish your testimony.
Thank you. I believe Commissioner Hanneman was in that chair.
Oh, we need him back.
We need him back. I've got him here. He said he would provide information from his county of their support, and I do have that here that I can just hand in.
Okay, if you'd give that to staff, Kathy, can you?
Yes. Their commission did take action. Their commission took action supporting the House Bill 3632, formal position on it of supporting this House bill. So they actually have taken formal position on it now. And he couldn't be here today to present that himself, so the chair will remain empty. And the other information that I had told you that I would be covering was from Coos County, but fortunately Coos County Forester is here today, and he'll probably cover that a whole lot better than I'd be able to, fortunately. And the other information, Bill Clooning, from the Woodworkers Union that represents about 4,000 woodworkers in the state, will be getting a letter to the committee in support of the bill. That they're very concerned about the jobs in the woods, and that will be coming to the committee hopefully before the end of the day, that will support this bill. And I think one of the things that I would really like to stress is that I actually feel that the State Department of Forestry, I've worked with them for a long time on a lot of issues. I think we have a very fine department in the State Department of Forestry, and they take directions very well, whatever the directions they are given. And they do a very good job of whatever that direction is. They've done a very good job managing forests in this state. But we've come to a time now of deciding how we're going to utilize the forests, the state forests. And that's what this battle is over now, is what is the best way to utilize these forests? Now, when the counties have turned their forests over to the state to manage, I think there were some real expectations what would be done with these forests. When you go back and look at the history and read the histories and the expectations, it was really felt they would be managed for timber production, timber harvest, and revenues for the counties and the schools, and not a lot of other things, but the environment was really important too. And we feel as counties, at least in my opinion, and a lot of other county commissioners, that things have started shifting away from the timber production, timber management, and jobs and community stability in these forests too far one way. Our federal lands have been shut down in this state. We're starting to see way too much of that in our state lands. That's what we have to depend on in our rural communities for our jobs now. And I think it's up to the legislature to really set some clear policy on these lands. That's the intent of these lands, is forest management, forest production, and timber harvest. the environmental restraints have been set out very clear in our forest management practices. We do have the best forest management practices in the world. We've done a very good job. The Board of Forestry has done a very good job of laying those out, of what people have to follow in this state. They've done a better job than anyone else in this, not only in the United States, but anywhere in the world. And that's what these lands should follow. I also believe the Board of Forestry has done a good job with a forest plan that can operate within the Forest Management Practices Act. But they came up with an implementation plan that is not following the forest plan that the board followed. But this bill that is before you sets some guidelines that I believe is acceptable, that would lay out and give protection to counties of what we think is important long term to protect our revenues, to protect our communities for jobs, and still protect the environment under the Forest Management Plan and the Forest Practices Act. So I feel it's really vital that we move forward with this.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Berger?
Yes. Could I go back, please? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the implementation plan, shifting away from the forest management. Can you enlighten me a little bit as to who was responsible for the more restrictive practices in the implementation, so that it's far more restrictive today than the Act?
Yes. The department, actually, the different districts put the implementation plan together. The Tillamook District, the Forest Grove District, each district would put their own implementation plan together. And those were put together at the same time, basically, as the forest management plan was being put together. And then on top of that, a salmon habitat, salmon anchor habitats were put together. And as those were put together, restrictions kept kind of adding on top of each other. That's my opinion, is how you kept kind of adding restrictions on top of restrictions. The forest management plan allows you to do a lot more things than the implementation plans allow.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you're well aware of the fact that the Department of Forestry and the Board of Forestry has the charge of balancing the sometimes diametrically opposed interests here in regard to conservation on one side and harvest on the other. How does this impact that responsibility, and who other than the Department of Forestry is in a better position to do that very tedious balancing act?
I think the legislature has the main responsibility of setting the overall policy of how these lands are managed. And that's actually what the legislature has done in the past. And that's where the Board of Forestry gets their guidance to start from. And then from there, they start setting their policies. They get all of their authority of where they set their balance from, comes from the legislation that they work under. And when you talk about the balance that they work off of, the purpose of the land rule that that basically they put in place came from legislation that the legislators put in place. So I think it comes first from the legislation.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. Let's move on. For the record, Commissioner Probst mentioned testimony of Bill Cluding. Bill is in the back of the room on Tuesday, and I got a note from him that he was not able to be here. He will be submitting some written testimony. And he represents the Timber Workers Union or whatever that is. And then also, members, I don't know if you all have it, but also will acknowledge for the record a letter from the Audubon Society in opposition with a note to me that says they will not be testifying, but we'll acknowledge that for the record. Jim Brown, you're in the room today. I'd be happy to have you come forward. I know we visited briefly about this, and I issued an invitation to have Mr. Brown come forward and give us some of his perspective on this as former director of the department and now in the governor's office. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Brown. I'm the governor's natural resource policy director. I thought it might be useful as you're considering this bill to perhaps provide some context for you to think about as you're thinking about the bill. You've already heard that in the northwest part of the state, this plan covers 530,000 acres. It also covers some other lands up the San Yam Canyon in Polk, Benton, and Lincoln County as well. You also heard on Tuesday from Janet McLennan and the department on how the lands were transferred, and most of them at the time they were transferred were either burned over or cut over lands. The dilemma for the counties at the time was that these lands really represented their economic future. And so Judge Guy Boynton out of Clatsop County took the lead of beginning to work with the Board of Forestry to figure out a solution of how to get these lands into the hands of a steward to manage on behalf of the counties. And while the economic future interest was foremost on their mind, their testimony to the board also reflected a recognition that these lands were important for watersheds, recreation, and fish and wildlife, as well as the economic. It was really kind of an and-and construction in terms of what they were trying to attain. So they recognized that there were a broad array of values that were important to the counties, both in terms of the short term and the long term, and they were really trying to find a way to have that attained over the long term, and thus they worked with the legislature to put the mechanisms into place that you've already heard about. Now, the agency over the years has developed new forest management plans on about a 6 to 10 year cycle based on updates in their forest inventory. They started a new planning process in about 1992, and by that time, the agency had discovered that they had roughly 60 spotted owls on the lands in northwest Oregon, as well as a fair number of marbled merlets and later coho salmon that all three were listed as threatened species under the Federal Endangered Species Act. At the time, the approach was to, the technical term is avoid take, that is, avoid the killing, harming, or harassing of these species in order to comply with the federal ESA. And for the owl specifically, to use an example, that meant protecting a 70-acre core around the nestery, and then 60% of the surrounding 500 acres and 40% of the surrounding roughly 1,800 acres. Now, if the birds stayed still, that would be one thing, but the fact is they move around, which creates a lot of uncertainty for the agency in terms of trying to provide a sustainable flow of timber, which creates jobs in the local community as well as providing revenues to local government. So the challenge became, how do you manage this property given these encumbrances? Prior to the owl and burlap, the agency had used about a 70 to a 90-year-old harvest rotation. In 1990, the harvest level was 100 million feet. That was before pre-owl, pre-merlad, and pre-fish. And that was mostly hinged on the age of the timber. Because remember, most of it, again, was cut over land. It was railroad logged from 1910 to 1940, or was a result of the Tillamook fires, the three sets of Tillamook fires, actually four sets of Tillamook fires. And the previous harvest plans had anticipated that the harvest level would go to about 350 million feet, up from 100, over about a 3 to 4 decade period as the timber matured. Now, given the encumbrances that the agency discovered that they had, they felt that there were really about three choices that they could have. One was to use take avoidance, which was both expensive because you have to survey for where these critters are, and then to design a system so that you don't end up violating the Federal Endangered Species Act. That creates great uncertainty because these critters move around, both for the agency in preparing the timber sales, but also for the purchaser, as well as the flow of revenues to the counties. And if the agency sells a timber sale and later has an owl in it, it has to, or a murrelet, it has to cancel the sale, which creates a very large financial liability on the part of the state because of a breach contract. The second approach was to use a reserve-based approach, much like what you have seen the Forest Service use. And the third approach was to use what the agency in the end chose was the idea of using silviculture, that is to grow and harvest timber in a way that produced revenues, but at the same time, over the long term, provided habitat for some of these species. Now, Douglas fir on any given acre doubles in volume from age 40 to age 60, and it doubles again from age 60 to age 120. So the and as well as the ability to provide public values. So the agency felt that it was a fairly logical choice to use a silvicultural approach to provide both volume and dollars to the counties, as well as to provide some of these public values. And as a result, extended the rotations to between 110 and 140 years old. Now, what the agency gave up was, if you will, the internal rate of return on the investment, but not in terms of a dollar flow to the counties. And it was anticipated that the agency would have to enter into a contract with the federal government called a Habitat Conservation Plan in order to get the Endangered Species Act assurances that were necessary in order for them to conduct business in an orderly way. Now, as the agency was putting the plan together, they ended up using a computer model developed by Dr. John Sessions at Oregon State University, and this model is spatially explicit. In other words, you're able to load GIS data layers into this model to help you do your analysis. The agency looked at between 8 and 9 different alternatives that came from the different interest groups that wanted to look at different approaches to management. And looking back, there were some key information missing or some errors that were made in that computer modeling. One was the inventory the agency had was outdated, and as a result, it was grown forward in a computer model. In the end, it misstated how much timber was on the land. Secondly, there was another data layer that was missing in the model that compared how you're going to physically locate things on the land in order to accommodate owls and murrelets. It misstated the amount of volume per acre on lands that were infected with Swiss needlecast for the severely infected stands. The model assumed something like 24,000 board feet to the acre. Operationally, they were finding about 12. And then the stands that were modeled that were being harvested were in kind of bits and tags, as opposed to kind of a larger 60 or 80 acre unit that you'd harvest in, and thus different types of stands were harvested in the model and would be done on the ground. And the final flaw was that in the past the agency had always field checked these types of computer runs before they were presented to the board, and for a variety of reasons that did not happen this last time. At issue in the bottom line is, and you heard this from Dave Ivanoff and others the other day, was the modeling suggested that the agency would be able to harvest about 279 million feet. And operationally, the agency is projecting today that they can harvest about 200 million feet per year over the next couple of years. Now, understand that's, again, that's a doubling of where the agency was pre this forest management plan. So we went from 100 million feet to 200 million feet. But what's at issue is kind of the long term or even the short term, how much ought to be harvested, in particularly in the near term. And that difference is largely as a result of these either omissions or errors in the modeling. Now, one of the issues we also discovered was that among all the alternatives that the agency modeled, at the time we thought it was unusual that the different alternatives, they didn't look very much different. They all appeared to give the same results. In hindsight, these errors, had they been corrected, and had we known about them, you would have found, I think, more differentiation among the alternatives considered, and it's possible that the Board of Forestry might have made a different decision. And I'll come back to that point in a minute. As the plan developed, there were three voices at the table. There were some industry that felt that the management on the land ought to be timber dominant. You see that reflected in the bill that's before you. They felt that the land ought to be managed more like an industrial tree farm in order to maximize the return to the county. That the rotations were too long, who would mill them? And they did not like the idea of the agency entering into a habitat conservation plan because it's a long-term agreement, and they thought conditions might change. Now, parenthetically, the agency, when they have one habitat conservation plan on the Elliott State Forest, and there's an opt-out clause in that HCP if it's in the state's interest to do so. And that the public, if you grow this larger timber, the public won't let you harvest it when it becomes mature. Now, some in the conservation community didn't like either the industry's proposal nor the agency's and felt that you ought to put 60% of the forest into reserves. And do you see that reflected in Senate Bill 430 that's currently over in the Senate? The counties were mixed. They had a mix of concerns while they fundamentally supported the forest management plan as a group. I think, for me, that's a key in that both the statute and a 1983 Oregon Supreme Court decision contemplates that there's a consensus between the legislature, the board, and the counties in the management of these lands. And I think that you're hearing some voices from the Council of Forest Trust Land Counties that represents 15 counties, but I think it's in your interest to visit more broadly with some of the other members. Now, I think the questions before you, given that the consensus is contemplated in the statute, is one is, what is the position of the 15 counties? The second is, long term, what should these forests produce? Should they be managed as an industrial tree farm? Should they be managed like the federal forest? I don't think anybody wants to go there. Or should they be managed in an integrated way, such as the agency has proposed? I think all of them are appropriate forms of management. Society needs the goods, values, and services that comes from each of these styles of management. If you ask opinion, the public their opinion on the management of forests, recent polls show that if you gave a person a dollar, they would invest roughly 40 cents into the environment and 30 cents each into the economic values and 30 cents into the social values. The agency thus sought what we termed an and-and solution to the management of these lands, of trying to provide abundant timber supply, revenues to the local government, as well as the social values that many of the public wanted. And that was contemplated by Judge Guy Boynton and the others as they transferred the lands. The third question, I think, before you is contained in the last section of the bill that limits the agency to apply in forest practices no more stringent than the Forest Practices Act. OFIC testified that the agency going past forest practices was not necessary, and it made the industry look bad. Now, I would tell you that most private forest landowners at one point or another in the management of their lands go past forest practices as a proprietary decision because it's efficient in the management of their lands while meeting their economic objectives. The agency went past the Forest Practices Act as a proprietary landowner and as a way to obtain ESA assurances so that you had an orderly way to manage for the timber harvest on the lands. And as a way to meet its long-term fiduciary responsibility to the counties. To do otherwise, in my view, puts the agency at risk of violating the Endangered Species Act and be subject to prosecution by them. And the agency was threatened by U.S. Fish and Wildlife recently on a thinning timber sale in Clatsop County where an owl had moved in near a commercial thinning, and the agency in the end had to settle out of court with them. Also, you have some industrial companies that have pursued these types of ESA assurances, both in this state as well as in our surrounding states of California and Washington. So the question is, should not the department be in a similar position to make proprietary decisions that meets the long-term fiduciary responsibility that they have to the counties? I think, finally, on that particular point, the private landowner is protected from the downhill flow of what the state does as a proprietary landowner from that flowing onto forest practices, in that there's a key provision in the Forest Practices Act, ORS 527.714, that limits or very clearly says that there has to be a proportionality test on any new rules that regulate private landowners in terms of cause-effect. Now, the agency is certainly aware of the issues that are raised by this bill, and they have promised to the counties that they would update the inventory, they would rerun the computer model with all of the alternatives, and that they would ground truth that and then have the Board of Forestry reconsider the decisions that they have made. So in summary, Mr. Chairman, I think the questions before you is, what future do you want, and how stable politically will it be over the long term? The agency chose an approach that preserves options for the future generations while simultaneously providing significant social and economic and environmental benefits today.
All right, Mr. Brown, thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
I have two different kinds of questions. The first one is really simple. Could you not build into your contract a contingency for dealing with the necessary cancellation of sales so that you don't face a financial problem?
Yeah, they actually, Representative Barnhart, the agency has done that in the contracts that they currently have. At the time the owl first popped up, we didn't have those provisions in the contract.
I see. Thank you. And this different topic, mm-hmm. if I could. You mentioned habitat plans. Someone, I forget who it was last time, talked about the idea that habitat plans were optional for the state, that you weren't required to go into them. I don't know whether that's true or not. If it is true, what are the advantages and disadvantages of developing a habitat plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, no, the agency is not required to enter into a habitat conservation plan with the federal government. It's really a business choice to make, and those companies and agencies that have entered into them felt that it was worth what you gave up in order to have, if you will, to revalue your lands, because otherwise they're going to be, you can't really touch them in order to avoid a take. So a way to revalue your lands and regain access to them is through a habitat conservation plan, which provides you the long-term economic certainty that you have in order to manage your lands. And the agency has said from the beginning that they would not just go for a habitat conservation plan to have a conservation plan, but would make an economic decision on whether it was in the state's interest to have one. But the unusual character of these is you can't make that evaluation until you've completed the negotiations with the federal services to then make that economic decision, to make that business decision.
Okay. Representative Virger.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, I guess I want to kind of go back to the good common sense thing of where we are today in this environment. With the management cost rising and with yields dropping, the fiduciary obligation becomes critical to the people on this side of the table. In my part of the world with Eleagoras, even though that's beyond this bill, we have a $29 million yield with a $80 million sustainable yield. You know, this brings questions to your mind as to the money that is not going into the Common School Fund while we're laying off teachers and doing these things. So please address that, because I think that this 40-30-30, you know, right, sounds wonderful for the textbook.
Right.
But for today's climate, what do you say?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I fundamentally agree with you. I mean, the Elliott was a case where, you know, that was older timber. They had, again, that was about roughly 60 owls that we discovered in second-row timber. I mean, conventional wisdom said owls don't live in second-row timber, but the reality is they do. And they have, they're finding merlets in about every third proposed timber sale down there. And that's in poor habitat. So the agency, and the choice was, in that instance, pre-owl, pre-merlet, they were harvesting about 50 million feet. Without a habitat conservation plan, in order to avoid take, that would have gone to 6 million feet. And so in order to provide a platform or a pedestal for the future, the agency did enter into a habitat conservation plan that got the harvest level back to about 29 million feet. Now, do I feel good about that? No, I don't feel good about that. But given the Federal Endangered Species Act and the fact that you have those species listed there, that was the only choice that we saw.
Sure, that's a quandary.
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Brown, you'll probably be able to enlighten me, and maybe this just comes from a guy who spends most of his time on our Revenue and Judiciary Committee and doesn't get too much involved in the natural resources side of things. But if we're finding those marbled murrelets in every third sale, and they're, as you indicated, sort of pesky critters all over the place in there, it seems difficult for me at this point to imagine that they're as threatened as we thought they were.
That's right.
I mean,
they're everywhere.
If they're everywhere, then it doesn't seem like we ought to be treating them quite the same way as if they were as hard to find as we seem to think they were.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I agree with you, but that's not my decision nor the state's decision.
Yeah,
I mean, when the marbled merlet was first listed, and we understood that they like to live on, they built their nest on large branching patterns, the first thing we said to ourselves, that means they live in the spruce hemlock zone where you have trees infected with dwarf mistletoe. And that's exactly where we're finding them.
You mentioned on the subject of the ESA, you're concerned about the bill that it could put the state in the position of violating the ESA, and I guess I would assume, and maybe we'll hear from the industry folks later on, but well, first of all, I don't think we have the power to preempt federal law by this. So I think whatever directive we place in statute with regard to the management of these lands under Forest Practices Act would still be subject, I would assume, to the overlay of any federal regulations that would supersede the Practices Act. I mean, and if we need an amendment to make that clear, I mean, I'm sure that'd be okay, because I think that's implicit anyway, isn't it?
I see the way that particular section is written. It's very clear that you won't go past forest practices under any circumstances.
But again, there's still federal laws out there that you have to comply with, irrespective of state law.
I think the dilemma is, there's flexibility within the federal law as to how you approach that. I mean, there are about four or five different approaches, and depending upon which approach you take, that kind of drives how you're going to approach it, the management of the land.
That's fine. I think it's a fair comment, but I think there's nothing.
And it has to be a business decision.
Yeah, but nothing in my intent anyway in looking at this to put us in a position of violating the Federal Endangered Species Act. I think that would be counterproductive to our efforts here. We get ourselves all bollocked up. Representative Farr?
Thank you. You spoke of the flawed model that Dr. John Sissons provided. Clearly, flawed models are rife in this entire picture that we're looking at right here. I just wanted to make a statement. In 1965, I moved to this country from England, and we landed in Portland, and my sister picked us up, and we drove from Portland to Tillamook through a moonscape, which was the Tillamook Burn, and there were snags everywhere. Right. I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything of that magnitude in my life. But underneath those snags, even then, you could see this little green fur mm-hmm. coming up. And just a few weeks ago, I was visiting my family in Tillamook, which is where I grew up, and I drove from Tillamook to Portland, and you couldn't even see the snags anymore. We have a wonderful working forest there, and it's just a shame that we're not able to make better use of our forests. It's you know, here in Oregon, our forests grow. Clearly, they grow, and where the forests grow, the owls and murrelets follow. You know, so it's not a closed-ended picture that we're looking at here. It's just a continually changing and a dynamic environment, and we need to make use of the resource that we have. More of a statement than a question.
Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Representative Farah, I mean, I agree with you. The Forest Management Plan contemplates exactly that.
Exactly. I have one last thing, and maybe we'll get on unless there's any other questions. But have you seen the revenue impact statement for the bill?
No, I have not.
Okay, it maybe not a fair question then, but
but you'll ask
I'll
it
ask
anyway.
It anyway, yeah, because I can. It shows a revenue impact of $90 million in total forest revenues. If this bill should be enacted, and I believe that number, and I'm confident that number is derived from harvest estimates that were provided by the Department of Forestry to the Revenue Office in order to calculate that revenue impact. I guess, do you have reason to quarrel with that number? It's an accurate number. If you would go with the assumption that the bill is enacted as it's drafted,
well, without looking at the assumptions behind it, pretty difficult for me to comment on. The one thing the implementation plans do is they do harvest the same number of acres that was contemplated in the computer model, both in terms of clear cut and thinning, and the kind of the issue is how much is really standing out there and how much is going to yield off that, and it's those type comparative assumptions that I'd have to look at in order to offer you as to whether that's a valid estimate or not.
Fair enough. All right, thank you very much.
Thank
for
you very
coming
much.
Down. Yeah, Jason Miner, you were good enough to be bumped from the schedule on Tuesday and come back, so let's bring you up. Thank you for your diligence in coming back today.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Miner. I'm the conservation director for Oregon Trout. With me is Aubrey Russell. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on HB 3632. Certainly wasn't a hardship to come back down here on Thursday. It was enjoyable to be here on Tuesday and listen to the conversation. Oregon Trout strongly opposes HB 3632 due to
I'm sorry, I asked you up. No.
Due to its undermining of almost a decade of cooperative planning between the Oregon Department of Forestry and the many stakeholders who value Oregon's public forests for the multiple values they provide. I think there's been testimony today already to the effect that this planning process went on for at least 10 years now, and it resulted in the FMP as well as the district implementation plans and the salmon anchor habitat plans. The Department of Forestry has struck a difficult balance since the 1930s, trying to discern how best to manage these state lands. Oregonians use these lands to hunt, fish, hike, ride ATVs, bike, boat, and just about any other recreational activity that we can imagine. As well, many of the lands are used for silviculture, and that is one of their primary purposes. The balance has not been an easy one to strike, and we've been involved in striking that balance for 10 years and serving on multiple public advisory committees.
The silviculture?
Silviculture.
Can you explain that?
Growing and harvesting of trees.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
The balance has not been an easy one to strike, and as I mentioned, we've been working at it for 10 years in cooperative committees and public advisory committees. Our fear in HB 3632 is that it removes the Department of Forestry's ability to manage these lands and handcuffs the same agency staff who were hired to make these hard decisions to a management scheme that doesn't fit state forests, the Forest Practices Act. The Forest Practices Act is a set of best management practices that guide primarily private forestry operations at this time, although they do limit state operations as well. Regardless, I think the public expects more from public land, from public state forests, access, hiking, camping, hunting, fishing opportunities than they do from private land, and I think that's probably appropriate. I don't think that in any sense people expect the same kind of access, the same kind of fishing or hunting opportunities on private land as they do on public land. And I think that's part of what the FMP has strived to accomplish, is to balance those uses, uses which will continue on the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest. Certainly it's a mecca for hunting. Certainly it's a mecca for fishing. And the FMP is a tool to accommodate those uses. And one of my concerns is the Forest Practices Act doesn't provide any guidance for those kinds of uses, being primarily a regulatory tool currently for private forest lands. Should HB 3632 pass, the department will be rendered unable to manage lands for these other uses. They're essentially bound to nothing more than the Forest Practices Act and nothing less. It's the point that Jim Brown pointed out, the last amendment at the tail end of the bill says that the regulation on the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest will be no greater than or no less than the Forest Practices Act. And Jim Brown also pointed out that even private timber companies tend not to follow that operation approach. Many of the public advisory committees that I've served on the East Side Riparian Functions Advisory Committee, Oregon Trout has served on the Forest Practices Advisory Committee, and we've advised to the Tillamook State Forest Management Plan as well. There's constantly testimony, and in fact on Tuesday there was testimony from private landowners that they often see fit to do more than the Forest Practices Act requires. I think the testimony here on Tuesday was regarding planting additional trees to what's required. The testimony that I've heard in public advisory committees is to the effect that often private landowners will leave larger buffers than is required by the Forest Practices Act because the terrain requires it. Things like a break in terrain is a good reason to stop harvest and not go within, say, if the break in terrain is 150 feet away from the stream, it might make sense to stop harvest there as opposed to stopping it strictly at 100 feet. I am concerned that the language in this bill says essentially that the state forests can't be managed to that standard. They can't even make common sense decisions like that, that they are bound to the strict minimum of the Forest Practices Act. Another concern in the bill is that it eliminates or at least removes from the ambit of what the Board of Forestry is going to implement the civil and criminal penalties under the Forest Practices Act. Now, I'm not particularly interested in the civil and criminal penalties, and I've never actually had any involvement with them. They're something conducted entirely by the Board of Forestry and by the department. But I think one of the conundrums that it points out is that public lands would actually be managed to a lesser standard or to a weaker Forest Practices Act than private lands. And I think that shifts the burden of protecting public resources like fish, water quality, drinking water, whatever it may be, inappropriately. Mm-hmm. It actually puts public lands at a lower standard than private lands. I'm pretty sure that's not where we want to be. Certainly in the committees that I've served on, I have incredible respect for private property rights, and I don't want to see the department in a position where they actually have a weaker Forest Practices Act applying to their lands than they do to private forest lands. Finally, and more representing Oregon Trout's organizational interests and position, I think HB 3632 casts doubts on the state's commitment to salmon restoration through the Oregon Plan. Through its FMP and through what is currently an effort by a variety of interests to achieve a 4D exemption or some other kind of recognition under the ESA that the state has relatively good forest practices and that we can work towards exemption from the enforcement of the ESA with federal agencies if we just get together with them and discuss how the state can take responsibility for managing these species. I think this moves away from that direction, primarily because threatened coho, chum, chinook, sea run cutthroat trout, and steelhead all spawn in the rivers of the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. They're great rivers, the Miami, the Trask, the Nehalem, the Wilson, and certainly if I've left anybody's favorite river out, I regret it. I would also say that there's another issue that hasn't been addressed, and the Department of Forestry raised it. This bill will have an effect on the Sumpass State Forest in Klamath County, which is an amazing state forest, but is also harbors threatened bull trout. Sun Creek, Annie Creek, Wood River are all affected somewhat by actions in the Sumpass State Forest, and I think that there should be some consideration given to those effects. So, in closing, with my prepared testimony at least, I think the Forest Management Plan and the District Implementation Plans, which are just tiered off of the FMP, and I think were always anticipated by the FMP, as well as the Salmon Anchor Habitat Plan, which I, after Tuesday's testimony, I went back and flipped through my copy of the FMP and found the page that refers to salmon anchor habitats and where they will be implemented. And I think that all of that planning process, that 10-year planning process, deserves our respect as a balanced approach. And that's the primary reason why we oppose HB 3632, I think, rather than upset that balance. I urge you to reject the bill. I did think that Tuesday's testimony was really, really, really quite interesting and presented a variety of interesting issues. The Tillamook and Clatsop are not an old-growth forest that was raised on Tuesday, and they're not a tree farm either. I think that was addressed on Tuesday. They're somewhere in between, and that's exactly why the FMP was developed, to address what is a silviculturally unique forest. And I think that this bill sort of throws all that planning to address these silvicultural issues into a bit of chaos. As well, it affects forests like the Sumpass or the Elliott in ways that we may not have anticipated, because I think it is largely targeted towards or drafted towards the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. And finally, I think there's been a lot of testimony to the effect that we're on thin ice regarding the science and what exactly the science says. And science is a very difficult thing to judge. It certainly doesn't provide much guidance. It says certainly doesn't provide any definitive answers. But I think that what we can say is that the FMP was approved by ODFW, the fishery scientists employed by the state. They endorsed the FMP, or they signed on to the FMP, the Forest Management Plan, as an appropriate management tool for the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. So what scientists we do have, they have endorsed that approach as a reasonable approach, or what scientists we can check in with, they have endorsed it as a reasonable approach. Federal scientists have asked for more, but the truth of the matter is the appropriate management regime is probably somewhere in between. So I think that the science has been somewhat addressed, and it's reflected in the FMP, and that's a good reason why we probably shouldn't set it aside and revert to the Forest Practices Act instead.
All right. Did you want to say anything?
I had a few comments, but I think they've been
okay. Been
very well addressed, and I will just leave it to your questions.
Are there questions then for these witnesses? Representative Hess.
Thank you. The penalty provisions, what section of the bill are you talking about that takes that out? Is that the restrictive and no restrictions?
It's the part that removes to encourage forest practices implementing the policy of ORS 527.610 to 527.770, and then there's a removal of and 527.990 and 527.992, at least in my copy of the bill. Okay. Those are the civil and penalty
provisions.
Civil and criminal penalty provisions of the bill.
Anything else? Nothing? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob, is it Laporte?
Yes.
Okay. Come on forward.
Thank you.
Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to express our support for House Bill 3632. My name is Bob Laporte. I'm a Coos County Forester. I'm here representing Coos County Commission. They have not, to my knowledge, taken a formal position on this bill at this time. However, I've discussed this with all three members of the County Commission and was directed to appear here today. Coos County supports a policy which directs that all of the county forest trust lands shall be actively managed for timber production as the primary goal. We believe that this was the original intent of the counties in the 40s. I wasn't here the other day when some of that was discussed. Jim Brown went over some of that history. I know that it is the policy, has been the policy of the court of Coos County since the late 40s, that these lands shall be managed, should be managed to produce jobs and revenue as the primary purpose. As soon as the counties got the statutory authority to manage their own lands, which occurred in 1941, I believe, Coos County began accumulating lands of their own, which are dedicated as county forest under Oregon statutes, ORS 275.320. And as you may be aware, we have a 15,000-acre county forest, which we manage primarily for timber production and other forest products to produce revenue for the county general fund. We manage these lands under the Oregon Forest Practice Rules, which I believe are the strictest land use rules under Oregon law at this time. Anybody who knows me, some of the people in this room for sure, who's talked to me in the last couple of years, know that I find it incongruous that when you take a piece of bare land and you choose to plant trees on it, you become subject to the strictest environmental rules that the state of Oregon has, and all for the purpose of regulating that use of the land which has the least impact on the land. And I just seems ironic to me. The Board of Commissioners asked me here in recent days to do a comparison of revenue production from our county forest lands and compare them with the county forest trust lands on the Elliott, which have a similar history, roughly similar age classes. Our lands were logged in the early part of the century by railroad systems and were burned over and actually grazed. And I took a look at the numbers from a 12-year period here recently, and I understand that a direct comparison, there is some problems with that, but when I look at the dollar production per acre per year, that's a way I chose to look at it, I found that on our county forest lands, each acre produces about $250, $260 of revenue per year. If you divide out our average dollars received over the last 12 years. For the same period on the Elliott, I find more like $140. And we manage strictly by the Oregon Forest Practice Rules, and we feel that applying a some more restrictive standard to our county forest trust lands or public forests elsewhere implies that the Oregon Forest Practice Rules are not sufficient to meet ESA standards. I don't know that that's true. Nobody's gone to jail yet. Nobody's written us a ticket. We have provisions in our contracts if we encounter some ESA issue that we would have to deal with at that time. We don't feel in our county forest management that we should encumber those lands with a very restrictive standard that would reduce production from those lands forever and just on the chance that something might occur in one or more of our timber sales in a given year. I also wish to express my support and the county's support, county commission's support for a policy which would direct conversion of those lands which are severely affected by Swiss needle cast. I see that is in the bill here, that they should do that as quickly as possible. These lands which are be really severely affected, and we have some examples of that in Coos County, though not in our forest yet, become the equivalent of a non-productive brush field, and I believe they should be they converted to resistant species, spruce or hemlock, if it's within the fog belt especially, and that that should not affect harvest levels on state forests elsewhere. I would really entertain any questions you might have.
Very good. Question for Mr. Laporte.
Mr. Chairman.
He's yours.
I don't have a question. I just want to welcome Mr. Laporte from my county, and good to see you.
Thank you. I don't get
to see too many people from down my way. They don't make it up to Salem as often as I'd like. Mm-hmm. So appreciate your testimony today. Mm-hmm. I think that Mr. Laporte and I have both seen our workers and our mill workers able to recreate all they want to, because the problem is they can't feed their children and they can't they can't pay the rent. And
right.
So it's a
right.
sad. It's been a sad commentary for us.
A couple other points that just came up to me. Just saying that we manage under the Oregon Forest Practice rules, and that we would be unable to exceed those rules if common sense dictated it. That does not comport with my experience. We routinely, in some cases, will use terrain breaks, leave wider buffers if efficiency dictates it. We take our wildlife trees, which are required under the Oregon Forest Practice rules, and we put them into areas where we feel they do the most good for fish. We sometimes leave more trees than we have to. We certainly plant more trees than are required on the Oregon Forest Practice rules, and that's a business decision. We do that for silvicultural reasons. So I don't think that saying that it would be managed under the Oregon Forest Practice rules and not a more restrictive standard, I don't think that at all would interfere with the ability of professional foresters to exercise common sense on those lands. And so far as the implication that we're taking a big risk by not entering into an HCP or by adopting a more restrictive standard, I guess we don't feel it's that big a risk. Just because somebody says you may be committing a take doesn't mean that we're committing a take. I don't know what that really is. Nobody's ever showed us that on the ground as to what a committing a take might be, and we'd be interested in looking at that. If somebody from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or National Marine Fisheries would want to contact us, and we would deal with that at the time.
Okay. Anything else for Mr. Laporte? Thank you very much for coming up from Coos Bay today.
Yeah.
Nice day for a drive, huh?
It was. It will be.
All right. Let's bring up Ralph Saperstein and Jim Geisinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ralph Saperstein. I submitted a statement, but because you've been listening to this issue for 3 hours over the past 2 days, or Tuesday and today, I'll spare you that, and you can read it if you'd like. I'm the public policy manager for Boise Cascade Corporation in Oregon. We own and manage approximately 600,000 acres of forest land in Oregon. The Clatsop and Tillamook State Forests are part of our raw material supplies for some of our 15 manufacturing plants throughout the state. But what I thought I'd do is discuss some of the testimony that I've heard, and it sort of concerns me because we've created this comparison of public lands versus private tree farms, and I really don't know what a tree farm is. And we heard that it's really a balancing act of conservation versus harvesting. And we always thought that as professional foresters, we do practice conservation because conservation means use, and there isn't any exclusive use of forest land because we create forests. And while we're growing forests, we produce habitat for fish and wildlife, and that's why we talk about the Endangered Species Act. If we didn't have Habitat for Fish and Wildlife, we wouldn't be discussing whether the Endangered Species Act applies. But that's what the Oregon Forest Practices Act does. It creates this situation where we have clean water and clean air, and what's not in conflict with growing trees, recreation opportunities. And if you have any question about whether private lands provide recreation opportunities, just go out on private forest lands this weekend or during hunting season, and you'll see that the public finds that there's lots of recreation opportunities in private forests. As I mentioned, that there's a broad array of values that so-called Tillamook, the forest management plan for the Tillamook has to address. Well, we think that when you grow trees and you grow forests, you create this broad array of values, and there's no way that you can avoid that, and that's what private lands have. And complying with the Forest Practices Act isn't one side of the spectrum. We think it's a balance in itself, and that's why we dedicate much of our land, millions of dollars a year in forest land, is dedicated to complying with the Oregon Forest Practices Act, millions of dollars in value. Oregon Trout said that the bill prevents the state from managing for other uses, and they mentioned ATVs and things like that. Well, we don't think it does that at all. Is that growing trees for timber production does not conflict with any recreational opportunities, and that, as I pointed out, it does produce fish and wildlife habitat, clean air and clean water. So it's not an either or. We think that professional foresters and land managers have the ability to provide recreation opportunities and habitat for fish and wildlife while they're still producing timber. That's what we're trained for. Now, if you don't believe any of that, you don't think it's true, there's 600,000 acres of state land we're talking about. In Oregon, there's approximately 15 million acres of federal forest land that are dedicated to the exactly opposite of what I've just spoke about for the past couple minutes, and that on federal forests, they're dedicated through political decisions, not necessarily scientific, but they're dedicated for uses other than producing timber. So if you don't believe my hypothesis, we have many, many, many times more acres of federal forest lands in Oregon that provide those so-called broad array of values. So it's not necessary for us to do the same thing on 600,000 acres of state forest land when we have 15 million acres of federal forest land. With that, I'll end my testimony and be glad to entertain any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Saperstein? Yeah, I think you raise an issue that has been in my mind, and that is the context or the history of this, where if you go back over the past 60 years, the uses to which state and private and federal forest lands were being put, you had so much more harvest activity, production activity on federal lands, certainly in those years. And I guess that really is the question that we're being presented here. The context has changed, that 600,000 acres versus the 15 million. The context of those 600,000 acres within that broader number of publicly owned lands has changed, and I think that does raise a legitimate question then as to whether that changes the order of priority of uses for those state lands. As a legitimate question, do we put a higher emphasis on productivity where we have, in fact, 15 million acres that are owned by a federal forest, the federal forest agency, that are available, if not exclusively, certainly primarily for recreation, for habitat, and those. The context has changed, I guess, over the years as to our relationship with state lands versus those other federal lands in the state.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, and my point is that you don't preclude all those other things, those recreation opportunities, fish and wildlife, and those other things, if you manage your forest lands for timber production. It's just the nature of the science that has progressed. It's not an either-or question, and that's what's frustrating to hear, that those values won't be present if we manage for timber.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Geisinger. I represent the Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade association representing over 1,000 family-owned contract logging companies and other businesses associated with our industry. I think you've already heard all you need to hear about the growth data and the scientific and biological justifications for this bill, which we strongly support. So I won't repeat any of that other than to conclude that it is an economically sound proposal and it's going to generate tens of millions of dollars of new revenue at a time that this state desperately needs it. It's socially responsible and it creates over 3,500 new jobs and will sustain existing jobs. And I believe it's also supportable ecologically in that it does fall within the parameters of the Oregon Forest Practices Act and our goal of sustainably managing our forests. It meets those tests very well. It wasn't that long ago that the vast majority of our members depended on federal forest lands for the bulk of their work. Today, they depend exclusively on state and private lands. That land base is the mainstay of the employment opportunities for our industry. This bill will provide a shot in the arm for our industry, which is still the second largest industry in this state. I think Oregon is the only state that speaks of its second largest industry in the past tense from time to time. But we are still here. We are contributing significantly to this state's economy. And the thing that sets us apart from a lot of other industries is that we do depend on a sustainable raw material, one that can be replaced over and over and over the decades and the centuries. Now, at the risk of getting just a little bit off the subject, I want to digress a little bit to talk about federal lands policy because it is relevant to how our state lands are managed. Ralph and I have shared quite a long history watching the evolution of federal forest policies in the Pacific Northwest. I think it's been a very painful part of our careers. It has resulted in almost a total shutdown of timber-producing opportunities on those lands. But there's some significant things that happened during the course of that evolution. The Clinton administration created something called the Northwest Forest Plan for federal lands, not to be mistaken with the Northwest Plan, Forest Plan that we're talking about relative to state lands. It was created under the assumption that state and private lands had nothing to contribute in terms of recovering threatened and endangered species. It was a plan that was created to sustain viable populations of owls and murrelets under the assumption that other landowners were not capable of providing the habitat and the necessary requirements to maintain the populations of those species. The Tillamook Forest and the Clatsop Forest were assumed to be incapable of providing habitat for the marbled murrelet and the spotted owl. And this plan was created under the assumption that only federal lands could contribute to that resource. 7.5 million acres of federal land was set aside as critical habitat for the spotted owl alone in Washington and Oregon and Northern California. So I find it a little bit ironic that our state policies are being driven largely about concerns with the Endangered Species Act. And I'm not suggesting for a second that the state shirk its responsibilities for complying with the Endangered Species Act. But it is a little frustrating for us in the industry that have watched a forest burn down 3 or 4 times, salvage logs using techniques that would be illegal today, driving heavy equipment up and down streams that are now home to the threatened salmon, using ground-based equipment on slopes that were so steep they shouldn't have had that equipment on them, employing logging practices that people would probably term abusive today compared to the way we do things today, yet the muralist's back, the owl's back, the fish are back. And I think, if anything, the Tillamook should be held out as an example of resiliency, sustainability, and renewability. And I think it's incumbent upon you as policy setters to recognize the potential of those lands to produce much-needed fiber and to do it in an ecologically sustainable way for the welfare of the counties that depend on those lands, for the industry that depends on the timber, and for the communities that depend on the industry. I encourage you to pass this bill. I think it is it's a worthwhile endeavor, one that's going to pay benefits many, many times over during the course of the future, and I appreciate the opportunity to express our support for it.
All right, Mr. Esger, thank you very much. Questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, if you could just put a little context for me in terms of some of these numbers. The forest, the state forest area that we're discussing right now, you said was about 600,000 square miles.
Eight square acres.
And the federal forest in Oregon is 15 million. How much is private?
There's, and hopefully somebody would correct me, but I think there's 8 million acres of private forest land in Oregon.
Okay. And other than the 600 that we're talking about now, is there other state?
Yes.
And how much
other,
more that is? I'm just trying to get a handle on how these numbers.
Maybe somebody from the state forest department could yell out the answer.
What was the question?
How many state forest land acres are there in Oregon?
789,000 acres in common school land and board of water.
Okay.
Well, 789,000 in common school land and
Tillamook type land.
Okay.
So it's a very small percentage of total forest land.
And 8 million, you said, for
private.
Thank you.
I thought you were going to ask me how big an acre was.
No. I'm just trying to get scale.
You're getting numbers from the back row that say 10 million.
Oh. Oh,
sure.
I knew I
was somewhere between 8 and 10 million.
There you go.
Representative Hess.
An acre is 43,000 square feet.
Oh, thank you for that.
That clears it up for you.
But the only reason he knows that is he was covering the timber issues as a reporter in the early 90s, and we taught him that.
Is it? I thought it was 44 and some. Is it
43,560.
Okay.
Approximately.
Oh, okay, it rounds up to 44. That's about as though we're both.
Good enough for government work.
Yeah, that's right.
Or 640 acres to a square mile.
Yes, that's true. 640 acres to a square mile.
I won't ask how many square acres there are in the state of Oregon. I put a challenge to the representative. Thank you.
Now we're getting into a geography meeting.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, both of you. Chuck Bennett, you've been very patient. I appreciate that. And then if I could just put Dave Ivanoff, Ray Wilkinson, and Mark Nelson, or one or the three of you, on notice to come back up and maybe respond to some of the questions we've developed in the course of the morning's testimony. Bring you up next. Chuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We support this bill. I want to a couple of things prompted COSA to appear and also testify on the bill. One, we wanted to be sure to underscore the $36 million contained each of the two shown biennium in the bill. This represents, under current ADMW, $24 per student statewide. We believe it's a substantial amount of money and take it very seriously. We're very pleased that the supporters of the bill brought it to you and that the committee decided to advance it. Along with just the general funding issue, and we think, again, it's important, are the attendant job creation issues in the affected communities have a substantial impact on school funding, and we're very concerned about it. The final issue, and I'll just be very brief, it's come up a number of times, is the Elliott State Forest. And we've testified a couple of times now in hearings in front of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources in Ways and Means about our concern relative to the common school lands and the management of them. And we hope that this bill represents perhaps a shift in policy direction and that we'll see some additional bills in the future around this issue. We certainly intend to pursue this in upcoming the interim as well as in future sessions. Let me just quote from a report released in February that was given to the Division of State Lands regarding management of common school fund lands. On the Elliott, the shift in emphasis from intensive timber production toward more protection and enhancement of wildlife habitat led to a reduction of annual harvest. The result of that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is that we have seen the most valuable single asset to the Common School Fund, the Elliott State Forest, $850 million asset, now producing only $10.4 million worth of revenue to the Common School Fund. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, we would be better off putting that $850 million into a real good checking account, interest-bearing checking account, than to hang on to that asset. And we're very concerned that the kind of management practices that are occurring on the Tillamook and Clatsop also are on the Tillamook Forest are also going on the Elliott, and the result is the beneficiaries of the Common School Fund, the school children of Oregon, are not receiving a full benefit of that asset. And the question seriously becomes, how long does the state of Oregon retain the asset under this kind of management plan, or when do we start looking for a better way to invest that $850 million? Frankly, we think holding land assets as part of a comprehensive and complete portfolio is a good idea. But we have to see better management of those lands for both production of revenue into the Common School Fund as well as, I think, and it's been discussed, in front of the committee and by the committee, we need those jobs down in that part of the state. Those communities are in serious trouble. So in this case, school administrators are just real concerned about this problem, and we'll be pursuing this Common School Fund issue in future sessions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Chuck? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Let me invite Dave Ivanoff, Ray Wilkes, and whoever. Maybe we had some questions come up that perhaps you can address. I'll let you open if you have any comments first, and then we can get back to you with our questions.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dave Ivanoff. I'm the Vice President of Resources for Hampton Affiliates. I'd like to make a couple of points. First of all, relative to the revenue impact statement, I would like to respectfully disagree that there would not be any positive revenue impact in the first biennium. I do believe if this legislation were passed and the governor signed it, that there would be a strong message to the department to see what could be done to improve revenue flow immediately, and I strongly believe that there could be a positive impact early on. Relative to some of the testimony that occurred from people in opposition to the bill, I'd like to comment first and foremost about the concern that was raised that this would throw out the forest management plan and 6 to 7 years of public testimony. And I guess I would suggest that the approach that this bill could take, in my view, is to utilize the principles of structure-based management as a tool to achieve the objectives of not only revenue flow and timber production, but also fish and wildlife habitat, recreation, etc. In my view, the implementation plans assume structure-based management as the goal, and that's a fundamentally different approach to things, but utilizing this legislation in the manner that I envision, structure-based management could be part of the process. So it is not throwing out the whole effort that has been done, rather a modification of it. I respectfully disagree with the assertion that we cannot achieve environmental, social, and environmental balance under this legislation. I believe strongly that we can. The one area that I'm most concerned about in a couple of individuals' testimony, the assertion was made that Dr. Sessions' model was flawed. In my view, the biggest problem between the implementation plan and the force and the model is that the implementation plans were developed simultaneous with the forest management plan. The Board of Forestry clearly said that the implementation strategies are to be the product of the board policy choices that were made. And the reality is that while Jim Brown's correct that maybe the same number of acres are being treated each year, the same types of acres are not being treated. That's the point. The implementation strategies are fundamentally not in strategic and operational alignment with the forest management plan and the policy choice that the board made. I'd like to affirm the testimony of Commissioner Paul Hanneman from Tillamook County. Commissioner Hanneman touched briefly on the salmon anchor habitat strategy. And I just want to emphasize from my standpoint that while, yes, salmon anchor habitat strategies were discussed during the forest planning effort, nobody, in my view, really had an idea of what the impact of that was going to be. And I'm deeply concerned about the revenue stream flowing into Tillamook County as a result of the concentration of 150,000 acres, or about 60% of the Tillamook District's land base in these strategies. The last thing former State Forester Jim Brown referenced this morning is the Habitat Conservation Plan. In my view, the reason why the implementation plans are not in alignment with the forest management plan is the department is trying to enter into a very onerous habitat conservation plan that has aquatic and riparian strategies that go far beyond what the Forest Practice Act calls for and what science says that we need to do. A habitat conservation plan is normally designed for an older age class forest. Most of these forests are relatively young in age. It's not necessary to enter into this very restrictive HCP at this time. And while there are some landowners that have entered into an HCP process, most recently, I think if you tested the waters relative to private landowners that have tried to enter into an HCP, including ours, we evaluated that, and we abandoned the idea as being way too costly. So with that, I guess I would close for the time being, and I thank you for the opportunity to add these additional comments.
Thank you. Ray?
Mr. Chairman, Ray Wilkerson, OFIC, a couple really quick comments. First of all, apparently Oregon Trout made a reference to the enforcement or penalty section of the Forest Practice Act.
Right.
That's the way Legislative Council drafted this bill. There's absolutely no intent to not include that. If that extra reference, statutory reference needs to be added back in, that ought to be done.
Okay.
So that was, if that's a problem.
All there. Thank you.
Yeah. That was inadvertent. Second, following up on what Dave just said, there are no multi-species habitat conservation plans in place for private landowners in the state of Oregon. There is one company who has one HCP for one species in Oregon, and that's it. So, Jim Brown said it's a good business decision. Private people who are in private business have looked at that option and have universally rejected it as a way to deal with the. If there are other ways to deal with the Endangered Species Act other than HCP. And finally, and handout I'll give you, we've come up with a few bullets that describe the components of the Forest Practices Act.
Do we have that?
I've got it here.
Okay, let's get that out
somewhere. And one theme we heard the other day consistently was that these state lands are public lands, and therefore they have to be held to a higher standard. Well, that, again, our main interest in this legislation is that implies that somehow what we're doing is a lower standard, and we don't agree with that. And this handout, just in bullet form, describes the major components of the Forest Practices Act that private landowners have to comply with, and we think that's a very even environmentally adequate set of statutes and regulations. One of the bullets on there indicates the cost of complying with these regulations for private landowners, and this came when Measure 7, the Private Property Rights Initiative, was on the ballot. The state had to do a fiscal impact statement. One of the questions they asked the Forestry Department was, if everybody that has to comply with the Forest Practices Act sought compensation under Measure 7, what would it cost the state of Oregon? The answer was $55 million a year. So that's the value of the trees that private landowners are required to leave behind on their private land every year in order to comply with these restrictions on the Forest Practice Act. We're not complaining about that because we think it makes sense. But these are not insubstantial, slap on the wrist kind of a thing. These are real standards that provide real environmental protection. So we reject the notion that this is a lower standard that ought not to be acceptable to for the state lands.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Ray, I guess then this bullet summary of the Oregon Forest Practices Act sets forth the provisions under this bill, then, under which the Department of Forestry would manage the state forest lands.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Mark Nelson, do you have anything?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Oregon Timber Association, which is association representative of timber purchasers. I think you heard a lot about this bill from both sides. I want to talk a little bit about the sort of overarching policy and a concern I have that I heard in our meeting the other day when we were looking at the fiscal impact. And the department indicated that one of their concerns was a bill. I think the comment was, well, if we pass this bill, someone's going to come and take all this away from us. The implication is that there will be a ballot measure initiative, and that would lock up this forest, and that certainly has been proposed. And there is a bill in the Senate, that's Senate Bill 430, which would basically lock up half of these forests. I come to you today not really on the association, but from my background in running the opposition campaign to Ballot Measure 64, the Clearcut Initiative. And part of what we hear in this building is that unless, if we go in this direction, it's going to invite an initiative to lock up more of the forest. And I guess I'm here to tell you that under Ballot Measure 64, the overwhelming public opinion was in support of timber harvesting in the state and the timber industry. And I think the answer to three questions that we posed in that campaign is indicative of where the timber industry has gone and where public opinion has gone. We gave the public in a survey three types of definitions of clear cutting. The first one was, one type of clear cutting is a timber harvesting practice where all the trees in a particular area are harvested at the same time. Do you favor or oppose clear cutting? 70% oppose clear cutting. We then gave them another definition. Another type of clear cutting is timber harvesting practice where all the trees in a particular area are harvested at the same time, same language. The area is then replanted within 2 years with young trees and fertilized. Do you favor or oppose? 60% favored that practice. We then extended it one more time. Another type of clear cutting is timber harvesting where all the trees are given in a given area are harvested at the same time. Trees are left in certain areas to protect rivers and streams, provide wildlife habitat and buffers for highways. The remaining area is then replanted with young trees and fertilized. Do you favor or oppose? 76 favor. I guess my message, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is that Oregonians favor timber harvesting under these kinds of conditions, which are the conditions of the Forest Practices Act. And the very act that we are saying we should be harvesting the trees in the Tillamook and Clatsop Forest. 81%, when it was all done, 81% of Oregonians supported that concept of timber harvesting in this state. So I guess our response is to the threat of an initiative is we need Oregonians understand the value of timber harvesting. I believe they understand and support this bill as written because I think they reaffirmed that in their vote on Ballot Measure 64.
Well, didn't we see an article in the paper here in the last week? It's the one that showed that sales tax is up to a historic high of 44%. But also there was a question in there about increased harvest off of state forest lands, and I think I saw 71% favorable in that poll.
Mr. Chairman,
which would be consistent with the numbers you're giving us.
So we have done survey research for the timber industry since 1988, and I can tell you it has been consistent in terms of Oregonian support for harvesting. And one of the questions that came up actually from the industry on Ballot Measure 64, we had some people in the industry say, well, you know, we're not going to win this measure. I mean, people don't support timber harvesting in Oregon. They don't. We've lost the spotted owl. And our response was that people didn't vote on the spotted owl in Oregon. They never had a vote on the spotted owl. They finally had a vote about Measure 64, and I believe that was overwhelming.
Let me ask one question that's come up, if I could direct your language, attention to the language of the bill, on page 3, lines 10 and 11, and this is the language that says the board may not allow or require more restrictive standards. And we've heard testimony about how in private forest land management you sometimes do plant more than the minimum trees required. You do make the breaks based on terrain, not based on the strict foot count. What about that? Do we need to modify this language to give some, just in concept, I'm not asking you to commit to anything, but Do we need to allow for some measure of flexibility there? Is this language too restrictive, perhaps?
And Mr. Chairman, I think it may be, and you're right, and the private landowners do the same thing as Coos County does. The stream buffers that we leave, there's some removal allowed under the law, but in most cases we don't remove any. We just leave all of them. So that's an example of going beyond the minimum requirements. If there was a way to adjust this language, one of the things that's a little bit apples and oranges is that the state basically markets their timber through timber sales. So they put up a sale and with so much volume projected, and people bid on it, the high bidder gets it and harvests it. So the description of what's available to be harvested, I would expect would have to be part of the sale that's offered. But I guess the point is, if there could be language that's written as clearly directs the Board of Forestry that the environmental standards on state land should parallel practices on private land. That's the objective.
We don't need to do this now, but I'm just wondering offhand if you just take that sentence out and leave in the sentence that's there that says that the management will be achieved through compliance with, and then you reference those statutes, which is the Forest Practices Act, if that provides enough of a directive, but also the same kind of flexibility that private landowners have in achieving the compliance with that without necessarily the literal compliance.
I think with the appropriate legislative history, such as what you just said, that's been recorded, that would be
something to look at. Anyway.
Right.
Okay. And we've talked about the penalty issue. You also, we're not in work session, but you also, did you want to talk about the Dash 1 amendments? Do we have those distributed?
No.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, what was brought to people who, when they first read this bill, noticed that it doesn't apply quite as broadly as it should. I think if the management practices on the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest are going to be changed due to direction from the legislature, the same direction ought to be given to other state Board of Forestry lands. And the bulk of them are the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest, but there's some scattered lands in Linn County, in Benton County, Lane County, and there's a few even in Southwest Oregon that ought to be included in the same change of policy, and the Dash 1 amendments would do that.
Okay, we'll take a look at those next time we hear it. I assume that necessitate a change in the revenue impact if we're talking about increased harvest off some additional land. Well, we don't need to get into it now.
He's actually done the back of the envelope calculation of what that would be.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, on the spreadsheet that I gave you all on Tuesday, the very bottom bullet, item E, is a forecast of the additional revenue impact. Rather than $90 million a year, it would be $107.4 million every 2 years. Excuse me.
Okay. So that is if the Dash 1 amendments were incorporated and we expanded the scope of this to the other state forest lands. Okay.
Correct.
All right. Anything else for these gentlemen? I appreciate you coming back. We will have this back up next week, maybe talk about some amendments between now and then. Also, I want to acknowledge we did get written testimony now from Bill Cluding, representing the Western Council of Industrial Workers, supporting the bill. So that was a testimony I think that Commissioner Probst said would be forthcoming, and we have it. All right. Thank you very much. I want to close the public hearing on House Bill 3632. Before we quit, committee, let's take up a work session on House Bill 2747. I'll open that. Is that Mazin or is that you?
The amendments that you might want to discuss.
No, we're not going to do those.
Okay, well then it's me.
Okay. The committee, you have before you some dash A6s to House Bill 2747. Those were intended to incorporate a bill that we never heard that was supposed to fix a Deschutes County problem. But when we got the revenue impact statement based on those, I think it had a more than $4 million revenue impact to counties, and so we are not going to do the dash A6s.
Then, Mr. Chair, the bill, to refresh the committee's memory, basically deals with disconnecting from the federal depreciation for...
Can you use another verb?
Please.
Unhooking?
Unhooking, there we go.
Distancing ourselves strongly.
Anyway, as depreciation relates to... essentially sports utility vehicles, and then adding in addition to the Oregon return, which would add essentially three times the amount of the advantage that's allowed on the federal return back onto the Oregon return. You have already adopted the A-3 and A-4 amendments to this bill, which the A-3 are the ones that raise it to three times the impact. And then the A-4 make it clear that vehicles in timber or wood products are exempt, that vehicles used to transport employees or customers of a construction business or a cargo equipment or equipment used in construction are not affected by this.
So with that, as I recall, that's taken care of the concerns that were expressed, at least on the trade side, the yes. business and trade side. So I don't think there's any organized opposition to this at this point. Then, all right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hass.
I would move HB 2747A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative? Representative, we've already done the amendment, so there's no more amending. Representative Hass moves the House Bill 2747 as amended by prior committee action to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Barber?
Aye.
Hass?
Aye.
Austin?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2747 goes to the floor of the two-pass recommendation. Carrier? You want it? You got it. Okay. Thank you very much. Now we'll close the public or the work session on House Bill 2747, and we are adjourned. And now...